From the Sky News Centre at 6, a woman's in a critical condition in hospital after she and three others were stabbed in a car park in southwest London. A man's been arrested on suspicion of attempted murder after the incident near a Sainsbury's in Hampton. Police are treating it as a random attack. Crews searching for the missing Egypt airplane, which came down in the Mediterranean Sea, say they have found human remains, luggage and passenger seats in the water. Yesterday there was confusion as to whether debris had actually been found, but Egypt's tourism minister Yahya Rashid denies there's been any misinformation from his country.
There was no stories telling. All what the people came out and said is there is not enough information at this point of time. So there is nothing but the truth. If you compare the Egyptian message with the French message, it's the same.
A man who jumped over the perimeter wall of Buckingham Palace spent almost 10 minutes admiring the gardens and asked officers, "Is Mam in?" A court's also heard Dennis Hennessy as a convicted killer after beating a homeless man to death in 1992. The 41-year-old has admitted trespassing on Wednesday and was sentenced to 4 months in jail. Rachel lives near Hennessy in Wembley in London.
I was surprised and shocked. He used to work and he lost his job the last year, and then he was going through a hard time, you know. So we never think Dennis would do something like that, I'll be honest with you, you know.
New figures show NHS trusts in England ended the financial year with a record deficit of more than £2 billion. Around three quarters of hospitals are in the red. In sport football, Brendan Rodgers is the new manager of Celtic. The former Liverpool boss has agreed a 12-month rolling contract. He says it's a huge honour. And England's cricketers are doing well, approaching the end of day two of the first test against Sri Lanka. They were bowled out for 298 at Headingley. In reply a short time ago, Sri Lanka were 89 for 7. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is journalist and author of Who Owns Britain and Who Owns the World, a wonderful double book set there, Kevin Cahill. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, momentous events this week, virtually unreported here in Britain though. I'm talking about the death of the top US lawyer and author Mark Lane. He began the process of opening up the corruption of the Warren Commission into the 1963 assassination of US President John F. Kennedy. After our 50-year commemoration of the Kennedy assassination back in 2013 on this programme, Mark Lane explains tonight how a team of CIA assassins were able to get round the Dallas police, simply vanish after the assassination, as well as he names the names within the CIA that actually murdered the president. Also, a century this week since the Sykes-Picot Agreement was signed. This secret treaty between Britain and France divided up the old Ottoman Empire after the First World War. Many Arabs and Western scholars blame Sykes and Picot for drawing arbitrary borders across the Middle East. We also take a look at how Sykes-Picot was linked to the Balfour Declaration demanding a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Also, we'll be joined by Vince Howard, new chair of Avon and Somerset Police Federation, who'll be reporting back on this week's Bournemouth conference, where he had the pleasure of another pep talk from every policeman's favourite Home Secretary, Theresa May. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 and showers. This weekend, highs 16 Celsius. Plenty of showers this weekend with some sunny spells on Sunday. Next week, highs of 16, sunnier at the beginning of the week, but wetter towards the end. And next weekend, the 28th and 29th of May, highs of 16 Celsius. Cloudy with showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is journalist and author of Who Owns Britain and Who Owns the World, two books I hope you all have on your bookshelves. That's Kevin Cahill. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hiya, Tony.
Now, I brought you in particularly, thanks ever so much for coming, because I thought since we had the Queen's speech this week, we'd have a little look at the real power and ownership and property that the Queen owns. We had a discussion, I think, a couple of years ago on this programme with Simon Fairley, didn't we, about whether Britain was still a feudal country. And I know, certainly, if you look at the amount of wealth that the Queen still owns and the amount of power she still has, it certainly begins to look that way.
It does. And the land registry, which is soon to be privatised secretly, we still don't know very much about what's going to go on. The land registry says, which they won't confirm, that she owns all land in Britain. She's the ultimate legal owner, which is what makes us all feudal serfs.
Well, we try not to be. We don't necessarily doff our cap every time. And all the other thing, of course, is that there is actually quite a lot of land around this area. I mean, we've got Highgrove, which is Prince Charles's estate, just up the road on the way to Tetbury. And I think Princess Anne's got an estate nearby too.
She has. A 2,000-acre estate, yeah.
So it's all a bit local. But look, in order to bring this down to earth a bit, you know, because this is historical stuff and it's to do with the Queen and vast amounts of property she owns and land, I've invited Rich Carey in, and Rich has been staying down at a squatted house down in Avonmouth. Now, Rich, first of all, hello, welcome to The Politics Show. Can you give us an idea of why you're down there? What's going on?
There was a auction that went through recently. It was 20th of April. Council houses had, in inverted commas, structural damage. Now, we're getting a structural engineer down to kind of survey the house this weekend. But the basic premise is that in a time of homelessness, a roof above someone's head, no matter how damp or how bad, is better than nothing. And there's plenty of community groups in Bristol that would help to do the house up, to paint the walls, to just get it fit for purpose.
Now, sorry, I missed a little bit of what you were saying at the beginning there. So the whole point really being that these places are fit to be sold onto the open market, and they're owned by the City Council.
That's right. The City Council spent about £8,000 renovating this particular house before it was sold, and that doesn't fit the premise that it was uneconomical to renovate it. They should have just sold it as it was. There's also a main issue, a bigger issue, which is an ex-serviceman by the name of Anthony. And his son Kai. Now they're living in a hostel at the moment that's owned by some of George Ferguson's very close friends, the chaps that I won't name because I'm not sure whether I'm allowed to, but they own the canteen.
Oh, right. No, please do. The owners of the canteen, I'm sure that's public knowledge.
They own quite a lot of the hostels within.
I actually would like to know who does own the canteen. I mean, we'd heard it was George Ferguson was involved, but who owns that building?
It's Connolly and Callaghan.
Connolly and Callaghan, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. They're involved in some hostels in the city too, are they?
That's right. Now the hostel that Anthony's in, there's cockroaches in there. There's a room underneath the kitchen which has running raw sewage in. Apparently, that's all okay. By Mr. Nick Hooper, he sent an email over saying that's okay.
He's the director of housing and I think crime reduction at the City Council. He's basically a council officer.
Yeah, he's a very charming chap, and he has decided that that's absolutely okay to have raw sewage underneath a kitchen. He says as long as there's a sign on the door and everyone's told they're not allowed to go down there, that's okay. And it's very interesting in a time of rising rents and where social housing was not being built, that George Ferguson has his fingers in the pie of hostels and homeless accommodation.
But I thought George wasn't around anymore. I thought he disappeared off the scene as of a couple of weeks ago.
That's right. There's a new mayor now, so we're hoping that Marvin Rees can really step up to the situation. I know that he's been looking at the situation very closely. By now he should have the evidence of the buyer looking to withdraw from the sale, looking to serve a notice of completion. So upon that, he should be really acting on that to withdraw the sale, to make amends and to bring the house back to council stock.
It's very difficult for him to do that, if not impossible. It's already been sold, this place, at auction. He can't go back on that, surely.
In 10 working days, if a notice to complete has been served, the house will, if the sale has not been completed go back to council stock. And I know that Marvin is going very much uphill at the moment with the old guard of officers that will definitely look to trip him up and to really cause problems for him. And everyone at the house is really hoping that he can pull through and, you know, almost... roll some heads.
Well, look, why so much effort? And you put your own personal time and effort into this, you know, which doesn't come cheap, does it, for any of us, over just one house?
There's a speaker called John Rees, who you may not agree with most of his politics or any, but he said a very, very good thing when I watched him speak once, which was, even if you lose a fight, at least you exact a price. And this is a price of auctioning council houses. This will happen if any more council houses are sold.
The other thing is that these people are hoping to move into this place, that this is a big thing for them, so you're disappointing them too, aren't you?
The council has definitely disappointed them. The council has not been in contact updating at all. If any information would have come from the side of the occupation, and I'm sure that after all the political dealings and all of the house being in the news and everything else, that the buyer wouldn't want to live in that house anymore. They would understand that it would be better to be in council
stock. I mean, surely if the city council can house Anthony and his young son somewhere which is better than the place he is at the moment, that's deal done, and you guys, you know, have really got no more business to get involved.
Despite the massive overwhelming political stance of the house, if he's homed, that will be it. It's more important for him to be in a home safe than to make any kind of political move.
Also, you're part of this organisation, which I go along to as well, which is Bristol Housing Action Movement. What is the sort of point of principle here about, particularly about housing and social housing? Why is it that people like you and I, and I'm just asking you this one, feel it's their right to take over a building which isn't theirs?
I think everyone has their own agendas and their own ways of thinking about things, but I believe that if... we are going to be born into a country, into a world that makes a lot of money and there's a lot of resources around. If those resources aren't fairly distributed, there's a really a checks and balance measures of human nature. There is a lot of ways that someone can act in civil disobedience, they can occupy a place, and I'd encourage anyone to do a lot more of that, because at the moment we're fighting a government that isn't really that nice.
Okay, well, Rick Carey, thanks very much for coming along to join us here on the Politics Show, and keep us in touch with what's happened. I suppose, really, I should finally say, well, what do you think is going to happen next week?
Next week we are preparing a defence for the court date. After that we will be hanging on to the house as long as we can, and really, ideally... best case scenario, Anthony and Kai get homed. Second best scenario, the council house goes back into stock. And third best scenario, which has already happened, we set a precedent for what we're doing.
Okay, yes, thanks very much. Now, Kevin, Carhill, what do you make of this little struggle that's going on? It's a little minute struggle in a way, isn't it, with just one house down in Avonmouth. Yeah. But actually, it's the kind of the tip of the iceberg. This kind of struggle is going on in many parts of the country. We've seen a big increase, for example, in evictions. We're also seeing now a new government policy about selling off social housing.
Yeah, I mean, I started at a very fundamental point. The right to a shelter, to a home, is a fundamental right. Because certainly in our climate, if you can't get a home, you're dead. Or, you know, so the council housing is the way the government is supposed to meet its obligation, especially to less privileged people in society. Now, the bad things about the government's building programme and everything else is certainly the last time they wouldn't let the councils reinvest the money they got. So there's a housing shortage. And it's, you know, chicken and egg stuff. If you don't build enough houses, of course house prices go up. And there was, I feel it was a completely false market created by the last Tory government. It goes back to Thatcher, where she wanted people to rent. It's much easier to keep people who are renting in fear of their jobs, fear of their homes. It's very fundamental, but council housing has to be provided on an adequate scale for the government to meet its obligations under human rights law. So stick in there. and, you know, force these guys to the wall. They have a sort of, they have a fundamental obligation to provide housing. And picking off small groups, which is what they do, you know, they'll pick a little group up here in Bristol off. People need to combine and really make the case that there is an obligation on government to provide enough housing for everybody.
Now, we had a story last week from Inside Housing saying, I think it was 400 and something, 400 and, not sure the exact figure, roughly £400 million it would cost to actually guarantee housing for everybody in Britain. And it would, that would mean every council across the country would be able to house people. Basically, I think they'd say it was about a month and a half you've got to give someone somewhere to live, to get them somewhere to live. And that's quite feasible for about £400 million.
This is, but as you say, it goes back. I mean, people, when I raised it long ago, nobody took up the idea that Thatcher was forcing the kind of capitalist housing market, you know, where people buy their homes, to one side, taking council houses out of the market, not allowing councils to replace them, meaning there was a larger and larger private rented sector, which is what the Tories are looking for. Because they can put fear into the hearts of people who are renting.
Well, there is something out there called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Article 25 of that actually does guarantee the right to shelter.
Tony, when you get to the Queen's speech, a consultation on the Bill of Rights, the right to a decent shelter is in the ECHR, and the government want to abolish it.
Well, this week we're politician free, we're journalists, and we're talking about the Queen, most of us. Martin, do you want to just give us your two halfpence on this whole business of selling off council homes and the housing market? Because it seems, and we were discussing this with Thangam Debonair last week, that there is a sort of obsession out there about keeping house prices going up and up and up. And when I say that, almost all economic policy seems to be centred around house prices. What's the actual effect of that? Is there any point to it?
Well, it has very deleterious macroeconomic effects. So it basically there's a bias in the system in Britain towards people buying their own homes, but not really, you know, but with subsidies being given for it. So, you know, Help to Buy being a classic example of that. And it's directed to those who are already relatively privileged, and they are going to be given extra resources or basically underwritten by the state to buy their own homes. And these tend to be swing voters in the marginal constituencies in our corrupt racketeering electoral system. And of course, in other Northern European countries, people do not obsess about property ownership the way they do in Britain.
But what's the effect of only focusing on house prices? So, I mean, almost like the rest of the economy.
Well, hang on.
The rest of the economy can go to hell in a handbasket so long as house prices still keep going
up. The classic problem is that you get big property price bubbles and bursts in Britain, and it's the geographical effect of that is largely concentrated in the south of England, places like Bristol, London, etc. And classically, you find that as the economy picks up out of recessions, house prices race ahead, and then they have to slam the brakes on to prevent inflation taking hold, and that, of course, prevents industry, particularly in the north of England, Scotland, the periphery of Britain, from competing in international markets. So all of our conservatories and DIY are at the expense of high-tech and manufacturing jobs.
No Prime Minister's questions this week. Instead, we had the state opening of Parliament, the Queen turning up, and all of the MPs and quite a few of the Lords. I'm sure some of them are too old to go, but get together, and it's a sort of deathly silence. I'm reminded a little bit of Mervyn Peake's book, Titus Groan and Titus Alone, those kind of where the whole kind of system seems to be ossified. Everyone's silent. People are making kind of meaningless statements. But thank God for Dennis Skinner, because he always breaks the monotony. And let's have a listen to that now.
Mr. Speaker, the Queen commands this Honourable House to attend Her Majesty immediately in the House of Peers.
Hands off the BBC.
Yeah. Now, you know what he did is he actually burst the silence completely there, and suddenly everyone's laughing and chit-chatting. So I think he plays quite an important role, Kevin.
Yes.
Don't you think Dennis plays quite an important role, Dennis Skinner?
And Dennis has always played. Often he's the lone voice breaking up the kind of the consensus that nobody admits to and nobody knows how to get out of. Dennis is a great way of puncturing pomposity.
Martin, are you with me on this whole sort of deathly silence that's punctured by Dennis Skinner there? And I wonder what on earth would happen if there was nobody there to do that.
It's an astonishing contrast to Prime Minister's questions, which we said we haven't got this week, which is usually a rough house. Our whole constitution needs to be re-looked at. It's the system is ossified, it's not fit for purpose, and being as we're facing the biggest economic, social, political, geopolitical crisis of the 21st century, it really is got to be changed.
Let's have a little listen now to the... we're going to break the Queen's speech down into a few sections now. And to begin with, and I want particularly, Martin, you to be listening attentively to this, because here the Queen goes into some of the economics, basically setting out the government's stall for the next parliamentary session.
My Lords and members of the House of Commons, my government will use the opportunity of a strengthening economy to deliver security for working people, to increase life chances for the most disadvantaged, and to strengthen national defences. My ministers will continue to bring the public finances under control so that Britain lives within its means, and to move to a higher wage and lower welfare economy where work is rewarded. To support the economic recovery and to create jobs and more apprenticeships, legislation will be introduced to ensure Britain has the infrastructure that businesses need to grow. Measures will be brought forward to create the right for every household to access high-speed broadband. Legislation will be introduced to improve Britain's competitiveness and make the United Kingdom a world leader in the digital economy. My ministers will ensure the United Kingdom is at the forefront of technology for new forms of transport, including autonomous and electric vehicles. To spread economic prosperity, my government will continue to support the development of a northern powerhouse.
Now, I did laugh at that northern powerhouse. I thought it had been sort of discredited. Martin, anyway, what are your thoughts about that, setting out the stall there for the next parliamentary session?
Well, obviously, what the Queen is there is being the ventriloquist for David Cameron, so it's not necessarily our own views. Let's make that clear to the people listening. Well, the most obvious thing today is the strengthening economy. But they've successfully bamboozled sufficient parts of the electorate to believe that the economy is, in fact, on the mend. I don't think it is.
Well, the figures actually say that there is modest growth now, don't they?
Yeah, very modest. So modest that if you...
Well, that means it's on the mend then, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't.
If there wasn't growth...
interest rates are at zero, and the deficit still remains out of control from their perspective. I don't think it's out of control, but they say it is. Now, in actual fact, in normal times, you would have regarded the situation where you have to have virtually zero interest rates for over 5 years as a pretty desperate corner to be in, because of course it's ruining savers. You know, a capitalist economy cannot function in the long run on a zero interest rate. So with a zero interest rate, they've managed to squeeze out some kind of growth. And of course, house price rises are included in economic growth. So in other words, it's actually a delusion. And I'm afraid it's not going to last 5 years. Long before 5 years are up, we're going to be back in the soup. And real choices.
Well, look, you know, you saying that makes me really worried, because I wonder how much of this growth is actually just purely house price inflation, really. It's not growth at all. Here in Bristol, this is in an article this week in the Bristol Post by Emma Grimshaw, the city city's housing shortage means the average cost of a home in Bristol is now a staggering £300,000. This figure's shot up nearly 25% in just 1 year. So if you've got house price inflation of 25% in 1 year, how much of that is going into the growth figures?
In other words, money is being made by estate agents, etc. But are we actually investing for a high-tech future, as was suggested in the Queen's speech there? And the answer is no, we're not. Levels of investment are abysmal. Productivity per worker has continued to decline or stagnate. The fundamentals of the British economy are weak. And we've had a 30% devaluation in sterling. And that should have led to a huge increase in manufacturing exports. But it hasn't, because we haven't got a manufacturing sector which can seriously respond to that stimulus.
Now, Kevin, you've worked on the Sunday Times Rich List. You know a few things about the economy. There are some people doing very well out of this. But what's your analysis of what the Queen is saying there?
Of the Queen's?
What the Queen is saying and what Martin's been saying.
I mean, the first thing is, we sacrificed, and it was a Tory government, Margaret Thatcher's government, that did it. 30 years ago, in effect, we abandoned high tech completely. Unfortunately, I was there to chronicle it. At the moment, the 10 or 20 largest high tech companies on earth, none of them are British. We are on the real coattails, and all this stuff about being a high-tech producer, it's too late. We missed the boat. But we didn't miss it. We failed to invest, and the party that failed to invest was the government. Ordinary people here and there put money into projects and things. But the bottom line is the high-tech future that the Queen implied is total fiction. It's history. We missed the boat. We're in a rowing boat, and we should be on a big ship.
What about, she's talking there about continuing the economic recovery. My government will continue the economic recovery. I mean, is your assessment that there is an economic recovery or not?
There's the economic recovery, and again, it comes around to, you raised the housing issue, and we can get around to that quickly. The economy can't boom if you haven't got certain basic manufacturing going on, you know, and things like high tech. We manufacture nothing in high tech, really. We've got one chip company, a really good one, ARM, but that's about it. We need about 10. But to come to the housing issue, all the spare capital that ought to be available, especially at low interest rates, to invest in production and manufacturing goes into housing. It's soaked off. Housing is very expensive because the amount of land available for housing is falsely constrained, and we don't even know. Because of the way the land registry fails to function, we don't know how much land is available for development, and we can't find out. Therefore, you can't predict. What you can predict is if there isn't an adequate supply of council housing and private housing, you get inflation in the market. And if interest rates are near zero, people can throw capital into it. It's not a good scenario.
Well, there certainly seems to be some moves here in Bristol to get large chunks of land which are owned by the City Council and social housing built on there of some sort, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But let's carry on with the Queen's speech, because I think in this section, if I'm right, she talks about the privatisation of the land registry. Here we go with the Queen's speech, looking at some of the more basic kind of domestic policies that she's setting out for this next term of Parliament.
In England, further powers will be devolved to directly elected mayors, including powers governing local bus services. Legislation will also allow local authorities to retain business rates, giving them more freedom to invest in local communities. My government will support aspiration and promote home ownership through its commitment to build 1 million new homes. Following last week's anti-corruption summit in London, legislation will be introduced to tackle corruption, money laundering, and tax evasion. My government will continue work to deliver NHS services over 7 days of the week in England. Legislation will be introduced to ensure that overseas visitors pay for the health treatment they receive at public expense. New legislation will be introduced to tackle some of the deepest social problems in society and improve life chances. A bill will be introduced to ensure that children can be adopted by new families without delay, improve the standard of social work and opportunities for young people in care in England. To tackle poverty and the causes of deprivation, including family instability, addiction and debt, my government will introduce new indicators for measuring life chances. Legislation will be introduced to establish a soft drinks industry levy to help tackle childhood obesity. Measures will be introduced to help the lowest income families save through a new Help to Save scheme and to create a lifetime ISA to help young people save for the long term.
Well, all very well if you've actually got money to save. Martin, I suppose the most interesting amongst the comments there was this thing about anti-corruption, money laundering and tax evasion.
Yeah, I mean, it's rather amusing, isn't it, that we've hosted an anti-corruption conference in Britain when independent studies have shown that the City of London is the money laundering capital of the world. And I suppose if you are the money laundering capital of the world, you have to go through the motions of pretending that you're not, which is really what that boils down to.
What about tax evasion, Kevin? Because I would imagine that the Queen is not averse to putting some of her wealth in places where people can't get it. Maybe even her own private little dominion called the Cayman Islands.
Well, the whole system of offshore tax havens was the creation of essentially Edward VIII's courtiers to conceal his criminal involvement in the currency markets during the war. So the palace flunkies have had a big say in introducing the tax havens, but I'll give you a quote.
Sorry, what was he, just before you go on, what was he up to, Edward VIII? This is the Duke of Windsor. The one who abdicated, he was very pro-Hitler, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he was more than pro-Hitler. He actually was on standby to reclaim the throne if Hitler had invaded. It's all come out now. But the key thing was he was exiled to the Bahamas or somewhere.
Yeah, it was the Bahamas, yeah.
And he had this Nazi friend, a guy called Wenner Gren, and they used to play the currency markets. And that was illegal for the governor of, an island to do. So tax haven secrecy and no recording of transactions, no recording of ownership, all that started then. In 1990, in October, the Sunday Times ran a wonderful headline, "The Rich Don't Pay Tax." And this was taken up by Gordon Brown, Paddy Ashton, and then the leader, but they all approached the paper, and the kind of landed with me because I'd written the story. But Gordon Brown gave me a great quote once when I went to work with him for a bit. He said he would turn the tax havens back into holiday resorts. Lovely quote. And the people who stopped him were the Americans. They dug in. Gordon Brown made a genuine and good faith effort to tackle the tax havens, and he was stopped by the Americans. They only changed their position after 9/11, when it became clear that the Al-Qaeda was using the tax havens to transfer money around the place. But they haven't maintained their antipathy for tax havens. And of course, Martin, you say London's the biggest tax haven on earth. Well, there's a few others as well, like Delaware, Nebraska. You know, tax havens, internal tax havens in the major Western countries are a very serious problem too. It's very easy to pick on the tax havens. But
well, what about the Queen's role in actually being the head of state of many of these places? I mean, one of the things certainly I've seen again and again, and it was a very good BBC documentary looking at the Cayman Islands particularly, was that at the end of the day, the Queen has got to be a major part, and the head of state has got to be a major part of reforming these places.
My own feeling is that she reigns but has extremely little power, except the palace officials who seem to be opposing any reform.
I mean, think, for example, in the Channel Islands, much closer to home.
Yeah.
The people down there will say, well, actually, the Downing Street and the Cabinet Office have very little jurisdiction down here. It's essentially all the major people who are running the Channel Islands are appointed directly by the monarch.
That's, well, again, this is where we need, as media, as journalists, we need to get much closer. They're actually appointed by the Cabinet Office and by Downing Street. And it's to break into, to get insight into who's appointing them here. Because this is not to excuse the Queen or anything, but it's more important to find out who's really doing it. And the real doing is being done in the Cabinet Office and Downing Street. The Queen's just signing off on it.
Okay, let's move on to the next section, which I'm hoping again now we'll have something about the land registry in, where the Queen talks about more domestic policy, particularly here legislation that the Conservative government is planning over the next year to do with poverty and education, that sort of thing.
Well, the
my government will continue to reform public services so they help the hardest to reach. A bill will be brought forward to lay foundations for educational excellence in all schools, giving every child the best start in life. There will also be a fairer balance between schools through the national funding formula. To ensure that more people have the opportunity to further their education, legislation will be introduced to support the establishment of new universities and to promote choice and competition across the higher education sector. My government will legislate to reform prisons and courts to give individuals a second chance. Prison governors will be given unprecedented freedom, and they will be able to ensure prisoners receive better education. Old and inefficient prisons will be closed and new institutions built where prisoners can be put more effectively to work. Action will also be taken to ensure better mental health provision for individuals in the criminal justice system. My government will continue to work to bring communities together and strengthen society. Legislation will be introduced to prevent radicalization, tackle extremism in all its forms, and promote community integration. National Citizen Service will be placed on a permanent statutory footing. My government will continue to safeguard national security. My ministers will invest in Britain's armed forces, honouring the military covenant and meeting the NATO commitment to spend 2% of national income on defence. They will also act to secure the long-term future of Britain's nuclear deterrent.
Kevin, yeah, we've strayed into the area slightly there of international stuff.
No, it's wonderfully aspirational. But take the one where she says that prison governors will be given unprecedented freedom, comma, but no money. You know, the thing is in a way a joke. If the government is proposing to maintain austerity but have all these aspirations, well, something doesn't match. Wouldn't we all love much better schools? Wouldn't we all love all our schools to be world class? That costs money. And there's no hint anywhere that the money necessary to achieve these goals is going to be made available.
Well, these new prisons often built under PFI contracts, Martin, and the news is out today, horrific news about the National Health Service deficit, £2.45 billion record deficit, and I'd imagine quite a lot of that every second of every day is going towards paying back these disastrous PFI bill contracts.
The good news is that it's not counted as government debt because it's all done as NHS trusts paying off their PFI debts is not national debt, it is the national debt. Say if they go bust, the state will have to step in and pick up the pieces.
So they're fixing the figures effectively,
yeah.
Again.
So it comes back to what Kevin was saying. A lot of this kind of aspiration is completely denuded by the economic policy that's being pursued.
Now,
in actual fact, we could afford to invest a lot in the things that we need to do, and it would actually be a useful thing to do in terms of improving both people's life chances and the economy. But you've got to throw out the window this ridiculous austerity obsession that they've got.
On prisons, there was quite an amazing idea, apparently, by Michael Gove, Kevin, about this is just this week in the news, about saying that prisoners should only go to their prison at the weekend.
Well, I mean, The Guardian weekly produces from the prison inspectorate, you know, horror reports. The prisons are dumps. They don't function. You know, re-offending rates are very high because people go into the prisons. They learn nothing except how to be better criminals, maybe. But again, you know, unprecedented freedom, sorry, but no money. It's just, you know, it's PR. There's no substance in it.
Well, let's go to a final clip from the Queen's speech, which is developing on... Sorry, did you want to say something else, Kevin?
No, this is where she talks about the Human Rights Act. This is quite important.
My government will continue to play a leading role in world affairs, using its global presence to tackle climate change and address major international security, economic and humanitarian challenges. My government will continue to work to resolve the conflict in Ukraine. It will play a leading role in the campaign against Daesh and to support international efforts to bring peace to Syria through a lasting political settlement. Britain's commitment on international development spending will also be honoured, helping to deliver global stability, support the sustainable development goals, and prevent new threats to national security. Prince Philip and I look forward to welcoming His Excellency the President of Colombia on a state visit in November. My government will continue with legislation to modernize the law governing the use and oversight of investigatory powers by law enforcement, security, and intelligence agencies. Legislation will strengthen the capability and accountability of the police service in England and Wales. My government will hold a referendum on membership of the European Union. Proposals will be brought forward for a British Bill of Rights. My ministers will uphold the sovereignty of Parliament and the primacy of the House of Commons. My government will continue to work in cooperation with the devolved administrations to implement the extensive new powers in the Scotland Act and establish a strong and lasting devolution settlement in Wales. My government will work in Northern Ireland to secure further progress in implementing the Stormont House and Fresh Start agreements. Members of the House of Commons, estimates for the public services will be laid before you. My Lords and members of the House of Commons, other measures will be laid before you. I pray that the blessing of Almighty God may rest upon your councils.
And there she goes for another year. Anyway, Kevin, yes, Bill of Rights.
No, this is traditionally, although not traditionally in the United Kingdom, traditionally Bills of Rights, like Declarations of Independence, arise from the people. They don't normally come from governments. And if they come from governments, they are normally a con. Now, at the moment, I'll demonstrate this because even I'm totally shocked by what happened. The Human Rights Act, as it currently stands, gives us a right to privacy. Good. When you try and actually enforce the privacy right, it doesn't exist. legislation has completely eliminated the ability of an ordinary person to enforce their right to privacy. Over the American PRISM intrusion, I went to the information commissioner, who is actually in charge of our right to privacy in the Act, and said, they're doing this. And he said, buzz off. He absolutely refused to do anything. I didn't ask him to take action. I asked him to investigate, and he said no. So on that basis, your right to privacy is blown out of the water. But there's always the High Court. If you happen to have 10 to 20 grand in your pocket, how many ordinary families have 10 or 20 grand to go to the High Court and say challenge a clown?
It does seem like with things like super injunctions that we've heard about this week, that actually the law of Martin is increasingly only really accessible to the rich.
The Chief Justice of the United Kingdom has actually recently said that. But there's a problem in between. The legislation created in the House of Commons actually has the effect. The things that stop you saying, I want to go to that American company who registered here, stole my data, I want to take action against them. Well, your first stop is the High Court, and now good for you if you have 20 grand.
Martin, what about the sort of these international issues that the Queen has been bringing up there?
Well, talking about Ukraine and Daesh, I mean, presumably, you know, we're talking about the fault lines in the geopolitical world that we live in, and there's pretty strong evidence that British intelligence services were heavily involved in the initial coup in Ukraine, and also in arming and training the rebels, if that's what you want to call them, in Syria. So Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, is on the record as saying that he was approached by British officials before 2011, saying we're going to run an armed uprising in Syria. And what shocked me in the debate about Syria that we had some months ago, where the right wing of the Labour Party disgraced themselves, in my view, is that nobody mentioned that it's on the record that Britain has had the finger pointed at it by a foreign minister of France as being the instigators of the armed struggle in Syria. So when we talk about finding a solution to the Syrian crisis, perhaps we shouldn't have started the Syrian crisis in the first place. Assad isn't going anywhere. He never was going anywhere, and we've tried to remove him, and in the process, killed tens of thousands of people and created millions of refugees. What a great success for British enterprise.
Kevin, what do you make of that?
Just very quickly, in Iraq, we did almost the same, a slightly different approach, the same thing. We decided we were going to remove Saddam, and what did we get? The collapse of a country, 250,000 dead people, and millions of refugees. So what do we do in Syria? The same thing.
Instead of invading,
it's just crazy.
Okay, moving on to another one of these big stories at the moment, and when we mention the last few weeks, and actually we first reported with Simon Hines from London, a journalist from London, back in September last year. It seems to be slowly picking up. Laura Koonsberg at Newsnight doesn't seem very interested in it, but this is the leaked emails showing that the Conservative battle bus had the full support this week of the senior figures in the Tory party in the Daily Mirror. A controversial campaign was approved by Chairman of the Conservative Party Lord Feldman, ex-Deputy Chairman Stephen Gilbert, and election guru Linton Crosby. It now looks like something like 11 police forces investigating fraud at the last general election last year, Kevin, and certainly more than two dozen Conservative MPs may have to have by-elections. Some people in this may even go to jail.
This story isn't even being run by The Guardian properly. It's Channel 4 really pushing it.
Yes, yeah. Michael Crick used to be on Newsnight, and he's now on Channel 4 News.
Ah, okay. Well, one of the victims, if you like, of the situation is the new police commissioner in Devon and Cornwall. It's crazy. She's being investigated by the Devon and Cornwall police over this issue in Torbay. But, again, the media are not giving us enough insight. The police have dived in on this. Think of all the things the police never touched. Think of the years of child abuse when a child trying to tell a policeman he was abused, told to shove off. The police feel, behind the scenes, that the government let them down over Hillsborough, and they're now going to have a go at the Tories. That, you know, there's a grudge match going on, and the media aren't bringing this out.
Well, Martin, the West Midlands Police this week became the 11th force to launch formal investigations into these allegations.
Well, I think presumably the political opponents of the Tory party have got a vested interest in pursuing this, as well they should. And the police I don't really know what their motives are, but the fact is, if the Tories have broken election law, they ought to do something about it. But I understand that a lot of the constituents they were targeting were UKIP, were the main threat. So the UKIPers aren't happy, and that really does start the right fighting amongst themselves pretty successfully, doesn't it?
But since we're concentrating a bit on the head of state rather than the government or elected politicians, Kevin, you're a bit of an expert on the Queen's wealth. Why is she at number 229 on the rich list when she was top of the list for the first 7 years? Well, how come she's dropped down? Has she lost all her land, lost all her lost the crown jewels?
Yep.
The palace phoned Rupert Murdoch about 15 years ago and said they didn't like her being at the top of the list and it wasn't fair. She didn't own the Crown estate. You know, we, the compilers of the list, were confusing her public assets with her private assets. So if that was true then, it's certainly not true now. The government, the coalition government, handed the ownership of the Crown estate back to the Queen. She owns the Crown estate. The figure of 325 million, whatever it is, should actually have another 10 billion added to it. Because the Crown estate is run for her, of course, and it's huge, and there's legislation and everything. But at the end of the day, she owns it. If she wants to sell it, she can. And it should be amongst her assets.
Okay, altogether, though, how much land does she own?
She owns everything legally, but personally, she owns a total of about 700,000 acres, about the equivalent of an English county.
So is that just here in Britain?
Most of that is in Britain. She may have over... It's always been rumoured that she has farms in the United States in horse country, but it's never been proved. The investments on behalf of... The private investments on behalf of the Crown are not revealed to anybody anywhere. We don't know.
This is a little bit like our very own merchant venturers here in Bristol, who, under the Royal Charter that formed them in the 1500s, they don't have to actually file accounts at Companies House.
Yeah. But I think what we should say is, fine, the Queen is head of state. Well, she should make the same declarations as the Prime Minister. You know, she should list her assets, and all her senior officials should list their assets, and so on. This is what's missing. This is first step. It'll take a long time to unravel the legislation that grew out of history, like the merchant venturers of Bristol and the slave traders. That was all sanctioned by royal warrant.
Yeah, she's also, I believe, actually immune to prosecution. Is that right under law? I mean, we've got things like the Crown Prosecution Service, which is her service. She decides, well, not necessarily her personally, but her Crown prosecutors decide who gets prosecuted. I imagine that's rather difficult for her to be prosecuted.
Well, there have been odd cases over about 100 years. Suppose for some peculiar reason the Queen decided to murder somebody, I feel nowadays she'd be prosecuted. Although in theory, and according to the Constitution, the unwritten one, she has got immunity. But I don't think that would survive the modern situation, unlikely as it is to occur. But I think what we should really be saying is, fine, you occupy a position that in other countries is elected. So let's have the same kind of declarations as Mr. Cameron makes. Let's have your tax returns. And let's have a list of your assets.
Martin, how come she's got away with this for such a long time?
Well, it's to do with the inertia of the British system, isn't it? The electoral system, the fact that the City of London is in fact independent of the government of Britain, we've got all these tax havens, the existence of the Crown creates a kind of grey area in which things like General Sir Walter Walker and sort of subversive military personnel can say, oh, well, we're responsible to the Crown, not to the government, and so forth. And
they've also managed to get away from any kind of freedom of information requests, haven't they, recently, I noticed. And there's a very good article on Business Insider from May last year by Rob Price. Queen Elizabeth II owns every dolphin in Britain, is the article, and doesn't need a driving licence. Here are the incredible powers you didn't know the monarchy has. And amongst those is she's immune from prosecution. All prosecutions are carried out in the name of the sovereign. She is both immune from prosecution and cannot be compelled to give evidence in court. In theory, the sovereign is incapable of thinking or doing wrong. Legal scholar John Kirkhope told Business Insider, however, barrister Baroness Helena Kennedy QC told the BBC in 2002 that nowadays that immunity is questionable. Although civil and criminal proceedings cannot be taken against the sovereign in a person under the UK law, the Queen is careful to ensure that all her activities in her personal capacity are carried out in strict accordance with the law, according to the official Queen's official website. If the monarch did commit a grievous offence, or she would almost certainly be forced to abdicate, there is at least one precedent of the courts prosecuting the sovereign. In the 17th century, King Charles I was tried for treason following the English Civil War. He said, "No earthly power can justly call me, who am your king, in questions as a delinquent." The court disagreed and had him executed.
Yep. Well, remember that the Queen entered evidence into court in that. It was a very minor case, but was one of the butlers was supposed to have stolen Diana's stuff. And the next thing, the Queen gives evidence saying, no, no, it was all okay. So the case never went ahead. So, but I think the point that should the monarch commit some terrible offence, I don't believe the monarch would be immune. In reality,
we heard during the Queen's speech a lot of talk about prisons. Everything's going to start getting better in prisons. Martin, I just noticed in the Guardian today, prison officers have been taken hostage in Suffolk, in a Suffolk jail, a standoff at HMP High Point, in which five staff were held by an armed prisoner, is one of three serious incidents in a leaked report. So, I mean, we've got an upsurge of major violence, drugs, and guns getting into our prisons.
Yeah. Well, the prison system is creaking at the seams, as anybody who has anything to do with it realises.
I mean, the whole criminal justice system, it seems, is slowly breaking. I mean, we've had lots of courts closed down as well, haven't we?
Yeah, and also you've got an awful lot of social distress out there. People are hurting, and when they hurt, they lash out. And they, you know, they try and get by any way they can, whether it's dealing drugs or whatever it may be. And that creates criminal justice conveyor belts which send people to prison.
I suppose there's a sense here, Kevin, that people are looking at the rich elite, seeing them getting away with crimes, whether it be to do with money laundering, financial crime, this sort of thing, and saying, well, if you can do it, so can we.
No, this is, I mean, this is a really serious, the imbalance between the rich and the poor has got completely out of kilter. When, I think when people feel that there's a way forward, they don't get so desperate, Martin, do they? But if they feel there's no way forward, then they get desperate. And this applies to the prisons. You know, an awful lot of people seem to be dumped in the prisons with no chance of reform, no chance of education. And they're just banged up. That's no longer working. And I believe if this is a hot summer, you get a lot more problems in the prison than we've seen in the prisons.
Okay, thanks very much, Kevin. You're going to stay with us for this second hour. That's journalist and author of Who Owns Britain and Who Owns the World. But after the 6 o'clock news, virtually unreported here in Britain, the death of US lawyer and author Mark Lane. That's after the Murdoch news at 6 o'clock.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.